From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, God in the Afterlife. Here's what's happening. Wall Street tumbling again after Britain's vote to leave the European Union is sending major shock all throughout the stock indexes. It's their worst two-day swoon in about 10 months. All three main indexes fell at least 1.5% in the wake of Thursday's referendum that has shaken global markets and led investors to seek safe haven assets elsewhere. Andre Eglishon, the successful talk show host and also author of Thieves in the Temple. Andre, what's happening? Is it collapsing?
Well, I can tell you, George, there will be problems going forward. The world will have to absorb this shock as a result of the United Kingdom deciding that it no longer wants to be a part of the European Union. You know, I suspect that the Eurozone, I've long expected the Eurozone to be a failure. I suspect that it is next, George. The euro, as even Alan Greenspan has said, is a failed experiment at regional monetary integration, and it is directly related to the problem that we're seeing, that we saw in the UK. It's not just an integration issue that they have with people coming in from Northern Africa, from the Middle East, and from Eastern Europe into the United Kingdom, but it is an economic issue. It's a real issue, but I fear that they've jumped out of the frying pan and into the fire because, you know, their leadership over there did not have a plan for the day after, and that is the problem.
This collapse, it appears there's a collapse out there, Andre, but we look strong, don't we, as the dollar now?
Yes, the dollar is going to naturally look a lot stronger than the euro or the greater British pound simply because, you know, we have the monopoly on the issue of the world's reserve currency, which is the U.S. dollar. And our economy has remained far more buoyant over most of the other economies of the world. So I think that there is room here in the United States to absorb the shock. But make no mistake about it, the debris from what is happening in the United Kingdom and in the European Union is going to wash up on our shores. We're going to be affected by it. I mean, you know, if they've got a cold and we will sneeze.
All right, Andre, my friend, thank you so much. I always love your input. You remember a few weeks ago I talked about a parrot that apparently had heard its owner screaming before the owner was shot to death. In Sand Lake, Michigan, a Sand Lake couple's pet parrot now could be used as evidence to prove that a woman murdered her husband. 14 months after he was found dead from multiple gunshot wounds in his Sand Lake home, the wife is in jail and accused of his murder. Now, the family thinks the couple quarreled over unpaid bills, foreclosure on their home, her gambling debts as well. They believe that she killed him and tried but failed to kill herself. Apparently, though, you hear the words from the parrot, which could have been his last words. I will not repeat it because I just can't. It's an expletive deleted. But it's a bizarre story, and prosecutors are pretty sure that they are going to bring the parrot in to see if it is admissible as evidence. Strange story there. Authorities are saying a 6-year-old New Jersey boy playing with a gun fatally shot his 4-year-old brother in the head over the weekend, and their mother now faces charges. This is a tough call. This was a mistake, a very stupid mistake. How in the world can you let a little boy grab a gun, a loaded gun at that? But do you charge the mother with that? What do you do? What do you go after her for? Manslaughter? Second-degree murder, child endangerment, who knows? Truly a stupid mistake, no doubt. Gun sales, though, are at a pace to break last year's record of more than 23 million, a boon to the U.S. industry and gun stores, thanks to election year worries about gun control and recent terror attacks, according to government figures. Under President Obama, background checks for guns reached 141 million through the end of May, amounting to sales of about 52,600 guns a day, According to the FBI, last year, the FBI conducted more than 23 million background checks, which are generally used to figure sales of new and used weapons. What an incredible story there. And for the fifth day in a row, the face of the sun is blank. No sunspots. As a result, solar activity is low. NOAA forecasters say the chance of a strong solar flare is no more than 1%. Up next, we're going to talk about Spooked, how the CIA manipulates the media, hoodwinks Hollywood, and also Kill the Messenger, how the CIA's crack cocaine epidemic destroyed journalist Gary Webb. Two important stories I want you to know about next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you. We have an amazing show for you tonight, and for the next couple hours, riveting. Nicholas Skow is an award-winning investigative journalist. Articles have resulted in the release from prison of wrongly convicted individuals and in the federal indictment, conviction, and imprisonment of a Huntington Beach, California mayor. He is the managing editor of OC Weekly, the alternative news publication for California's Orange County and Long Beach communities. And his book, Kill the Messenger, was made into a motion picture in 2014. Welcome to the program, Nick.
Thank you, George. Great to be here.
Did Jeremy Renner start in that? I like him.
Yes.
He was in American Hustle and The Hurt Locker. He's a great actor.
He was fantastic, and he's the reason that movie got made. It was really exciting that he was able to get this picture made. It's one of the movies that just doesn't usually get made in Hollywood.
Let's talk a little bit of some of your work. Tell us a little bit more about you, Nick, before we get into this.
Well, so I've been an investigative reporter and working at OC Weekly for the last 20 years, and I got into covering the intelligence community and the war on drugs when Gary Webb wrote a story back in 1996 about the Nicaraguan Contras and their role in the explosion of CIA crack cocaine sales in South Central Los Angeles. So that's a 10-year process that led to that movie being made, and I've written several books since then, and most recently I've kind of expanded on that coverage, looking at the broader question of how the CIA has essentially kind of manipulated the media in a much more subtle way than it ever used to before, when it controlled it directly back during the Cold War.
Aren't you kind of sticking your neck out writing the stories you write?
Yeah, I mean, it sometimes feels that way a little bit, but for me, I think because I actually knew Gary Webb, and I was actually getting my start in journalism when he first wrote his articles, and I actually saw how he was attacked by other major newspapers that were much more powerful than the Mercury News, which was the paper that he wrote for. And I actually knew that he was actually onto the right story. It made me really want to dig deeper into, the things that people don't realize are actually happening. And it made me all the more determined to actually get to the truth. And so that's why I'm still at it now.
I have been in the media since I was 19, Nick. Maybe I'm lucky, but I've never been approached by anybody in the CIA to try to change, manipulate, push a story. But I'm sure they're listening all the time. What do you think?
No, I mean, I'm sure that they are. And I actually remember, seeing how these other newspapers use their relationships with off-the-record anonymous CIA officials to debunk a story that they had actually missed. And so Gary Webb's story was very radioactive. It was like something that a whole generation of reporters back in the 1980s had tried to write about, and the CIA had actually pushed people out of journalism that had tried to get to the story before Gary Webb, and then the same thing happened with him. And it was actually quite ironic when, with this most recent book, Spooked, that's coming out tomorrow, I actually was able to go visit the CIA at Langley headquarters and have a very direct conversation with them about how they do their job. It was actually more humorous than anything else, although I was surprised that they were willing to be with me about it.
When I first started doing Coast to Coast about 13 years ago, and part of my background, Nick, is I had 9 years in the Navy, and I had a little stint at the Pentagon. And when I started doing the program, some of those hating websites would write stories saying, he's an undercover CIA agent. He's plotting us. And just unbelievable how things get carried away. But I can see how the CIA tried to manipulate the media to position itself. I had always heard that Elvis Presley volunteered wanted to be like a CIA agent. Did you ever hear that?
I mean, not him specifically, but you have to understand when the CIA was formed right at the end of the Second World War, I mean, the Soviet Union was very directly trying to put its message out there, not just in Eastern Europe, but all over the Third World. And so in whether we're talking about academia or whether we're talking about the news media or just American culture, for example, you had the CIA at every level, Hollywood, music, arts, literature, was trying to basically promote American culture. And so there were a lot of really interesting relationships and a lot of celebrities that were caught up in that. And, you know, what people don't realize is that the there were hundreds of reporters and editors that were actually on the CIA payroll. And so up until Vietnam, up until the Watergate era, when this was finally sort of exposed, this was a very standard practice. It's what was referred to within the CIA as the mighty Wurlitzer. The media was basically just an organ that was played by the CIA.
Now, do some journalists prefer to become part of the CIA without anybody knowing about it? Do they think that they're doing their patriotic effort that way?
Well, I think that before Watergate, this was standard practice. And after this was exposed, the CIA was put under much tighter control by the Congress. So, for example, they weren't allowed to recruit Americans anymore, specifically not American news reporters, but they still do to this day recruit foreign reporters and foreign news media, and they can plant stories abroad which then get picked up by American media indirectly. But you do have, in order to be able to do their job, reporters need to build relationships with, you know, anonymous sources at agencies like the CIA or the Pentagon in order to get these exclusive scoops and to become successful. And so the reporters that kind of rise up to the ranks of the national security press are the ones that are able to actually work that relationship. And this is, you know, a very pernicious type of media manipulation that most people are not aware of.
In your opinion, Nick, are any reporters, American reporters specifically, on the CIA payroll?
Well, I mean, that would be illegal. So, you know, if I knew about that, I would be the first to come forward with that information. But I think that the more important point for people to be aware of is that it's not even necessary for the CIA to actually have reporters on their payroll if people are kind of voluntarily acting as if they were on the agency payroll in order to, you know, get the exclusive scoops that they want. So that's the dynamic at work, and that's what explains a lot of what the media does, is that they're just kind of trying to get whatever scraps of, you know, top secret information they can get from the CIA in order to, you know, make the front page.
Nick, what was the motivation for the CIA to try to manipulate the media? What did they want?
Well, initially what they wanted was, you know, basically to create stories that would promote their vision of American culture as sort of, you know, supreme in the world. And so it was like a very patriotic thing originally. And this extended into Hollywood, for example. And so you had, like, for example, when Hollywood decided to make the movie Animal House, it took the message that George Orwell had, which was actually sort of, you know, very skeptical of the government, and it created a much more sort of patriotic type of message. And this again happened with The Quiet American. When this movie was made originally, it was like, the Americans were the heroes in the movie, even though in the book it wasn't. So you had a lot of that type of patriotic, propaganda that was being put out. But after that, it just became much more about kind of, you know, expanding and building on the national security state. And it just grew and grew and grew. And although there was kind of a brief setback for the CIA and the national security state, I think, in the Watergate era, when they were put under all these tight controls, supposedly, especially after 9/11, it's just exploded exponentially.
And nobody manipulated the media better than the Nazis during World War II. They even had a department that did that, didn't they?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the CIA learned all these lessons during that era. And so the types of psychological operations that the CIA essentially branded for itself were borrowed to a large extent from wartime operations when they're competing against the Nazis, but also that the Nazis themselves were using. And so it's very... there's a lot of obviously very dark aspects of all of this.
Nick, what about foreign journalists? Are they being manipulated today by the CIA?
Well, there was a German reporter, Udo Olfkott, who published a book last year that actually claimed that for years he was publishing anti-Russian propaganda on behalf of NATO and the CIA. And so this was something that came up during the 1970s. The CIA, you know, was told you cannot recruit American reporters anymore. But, you know, in investigating this, I found that the CIA, apparently as late as the mid-1990s, admitted that they were still actively recruiting foreign journalists. But they've never been held to account for that. And there's, to my knowledge, there's only been a couple of articles written about this, and nobody's ever really addressed it. So very likely this is something that's happening all the time.
You write about how the CIA has manipulated the media from earlier years. Tell me about the Roswell, New Mexico UFO case, which is so dear to our heart.
Exactly. I mean, this was fascinating to me because everybody's familiar with the press release that came out saying that there was this, a balloon that had crashed, and initially it had been reported as a flying saucer.
That's right.
Right, and then the Air Force came out and said, no, this is just a weather balloon. So it turns out that this is at least according to what the CIA, like three decades later, finally claimed it actually happened. It was a project called Project Mogul, and we had these high-altitude balloons that weren't weather balloons at all, but they were supposedly trying to listen in on sound waves created by nuclear blasts from Russian nuclear experiments. And so that's what apparently the CIA was trying to cover up when they claimed that these were weather balloons. But this is based on, of course, what the CIA is claiming they were doing.
So do you think it was a crashed UFO or weather balloons?
I tend to believe that this was a very early satellite program that they were trying to, not have come public. But it inadvertently sort of created this climate of distrust where, at this point, it's who's to say? I mean, there's been so much deception over the decades about what the CIA was up to. And among other things, just the fact that the CIA was very, very interested in all the reports of UFO sightings that were happening at the time. They still haven't come clean about what they know about all that. So it's too soon to say.
And, you know, part of me, my heart likes to think that it was a crashed UFO and that the government tried to and still tries to cover it up.
Well, based on the pattern of deception that exists over these types of incidents, it's fair to believe that.
It's possible. Hey, you also talk about how the CIA has and continues to hoodwink or manipulate the Hollywood. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so Hollywood definitely soured on the CIA by the 1960s, and especially the 1970s. There were a lot of very critical depictions of the CIA. And starting in the 1980s, but especially during the Clinton era in the 1990s, the CIA tried to build, from their perspective, a healthier relationship with Hollywood. And they hired somebody that was like a covert operations expert in psychological, disinformation. And this guy was given the task of building relationships with Hollywood studios to try to, like, rehabilitate the CIA's image in Hollywood. And it worked wonders. I mean, there's a whole string of films, all the Tom Clancy novels that were turned into films depicted the CIA in very sort of favorable ways. But this got even stronger much later, where you had movies like Argo, for example, which not only had the CIA as sort of the hero of this rescue of hostages, but the CIA got to be kind of a hero as well. And that took a lot of liberties with the truth. But even more, I think, kind of questionable project that Hollywood entered into with the CIA entered into with Hollywood would be Zero Dark 30 and the Osama bin Laden operation.
Yeah, we're going to come back to that because that's a very key ingredient in your work. Vietnam, Cuba, CIA was involved heavily there. Did they try to manipulate the media during that era too?
Well, yeah, for sure. I mean, people don't realize that the CIA was involved with Vietnam well before that war actually began. And so there was a lot of CIA involvement with trying to build public support for intervention in Southeast Asia, and especially getting President Kennedy.
Right. Well, they assassinated Diem at the time, didn't they?
Yeah, they were directly involved. You know, they had been involved in a couple of coups in Iran and Guatemala before that. But another one that people know less about was against President Diem in South Vietnam. And so then there were a string of regimes that we supported during the war. And one of the people that I interviewed for Spooked was Frank Snepp, who was basically the guy at the CIA that was briefing all the reporters from 1969 up until the very end of the war. And he just told me basically that the CIA was constantly tapping the phone lines of all the major media outlets that were covering the war and figuring out how to like play the CIA story that they wanted told in the press to all these different people. And for example, every year they would sell stories to the press that would tend to show that there was all this communist infiltration happening.
Hold on for a second, Nick. We'll come right back with that in a moment. Our special guest, Nicholas Skow, his book, Spooked, How the CIA Manipulates the Media and Hoodwinks Hollywood. Well, our next trip on our magical mystery tour takes us to Asheville, North Carolina. Full details at coasttocoastam.com. Just click there. Picture at the highlight reel. There are 165 seats left, so take advantage of it. They are going fast. Full details at coasttocoastam.com. The event is Saturday, August 27th in Asheville, North Carolina. I'm really looking forward to it. William Forstchen is going to be talking about EMPs and solar flares, and ufologist Micah Hanks joins us. And paranormal investigator Joshua Warren will be there too. So all of that at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast, Nicholas Skow with us. His new book, Spooked, How the CIA Manipulates the Media, Hoodwinks Hollywood. We'll also talk about his previous book, Kill the Messenger, that was turned into a movie in 2014 about the life of journalist Gary Webb. And that ends in a very sad way, Nicholas, for a great journalist.
Yeah, I mean, Gary was kind of a mentor to me. I remember reading his stories when they came out, and then I had a unique opportunity to kind of follow up on his reporting and expected that the rest of the press was going to do the same, and that's not what happened, and it didn't work out very well for him. And definitely writing that book was a really important opportunity for me to try to set the record straight about who he was and how he was right about what he had written.
Indeed. Okay, let's get into the CIA. We're talking about how they manipulated things in Vietnam and elsewhere. I got to believe, Nicholas, that they are still doing things like that, aren't they?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's been a lot of examples. Just for example, let's talk about, you know, one of the most famous examples and I think infamous examples of CIA and national security state manipulation of the press has to be the whole WMD Iraq war story. I mean, I mean, talk about Tonkin Gulf resolution and the way the American public was kind of sold on the Vietnam War. It was exactly the same type of blueprint that happened with the Iraq War, where the ironic thing was is that this information about WMD's misinformation, of course, that was coming out of the government was actually coming out of the White House. And ultimately, the CIA was trying to manipulate the press into getting, you know, different information out there showing that there wasn't WMD. So it's gotten out of control. But you have the press in a very sad state of affairs where, at least in Vietnam, there were a lot of reporters that were really doing important work trying to expose the truth. In Iraq, I mean, the press just lined up unilaterally and helped sell this war to the American public. And you know, this is, we're talking post 9/11. You know, there's been a lot of scare tactics that have been put out there, and it still happens today. This war on terror hasn't ended, and there's a lot of powerful interests that want people to be, you know,
scared to death.
Exactly. Scared to death and on a permanent war footing. And that's exactly what.
Well, you know, I wanted to bring this up. I might as well bring it up now since you have. Lots going on in this planet. I am convinced that if all real terrorism went away, that special interest groups would create it in order to keep their agenda flowing, whether it's selling arms, building more missiles and weaponry, or whatever it was, they would continue to create that. But I am now convinced that even though there are some groups out there that do hate us, they hate us because of our involvement with everything they've done. I think there's a bigger picture here, Nicholas. I think this mass terrorism that's occurring all over the place is being supported by special interests who want their own agenda.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, Gary Webb, just to come back to him for a minute, one of the last things that he ever said publicly was on C-SPAN, and he was being, asked questions about the day's news, and it was in 1998, I believe, And there was a story in the LA Times that morning about somebody no one had ever heard of named Osama bin Laden, who was declaring war against the U.S. because we had put troops in Saudi Arabia. And Webb's response was, this sounds like a guy who's angry at us for, you know, getting involved in Saudi Arabia. And here we are once again kind of creating enemies. And he mentioned a book by Jonathan Quitney, who is a Wall Street Journal reporter who wrote a book called Endless Enemies. And it's about this concept that we're constantly creating enemies every time we get involved overseas. And that's what's happening now. There's a lot of people that believe that the U.S., for example, created ISIS, and that's a bit of a conspiracy theory. Mm-hmm. But if you get right down to it, I mean, we didn't create these guys, but we did create the circumstances that led to their creation. And they took our weapons that we put there, that we paid for, the American people, and they have those weapons now. And now we're spending more money trying to fight another war on top of the one that we started to begin with on false pretenses.
It's even stranger, Nicholas, because we've got the capability of stopping banking, the oil. And this is my perspective here. ISIS is controlling oil fields in Libya and Iraq. They're selling the oil. Tankers are coming and taking the oil. We could stop that instantly. They're doing international banking. We could stop that instantly. Beyond the guns that they got with the Iraqis that we had left there and gave the Iraqis, they're still getting new weaponry. We could stop that too. We're not doing any of that. This thing is weird.
Yeah, and meanwhile, we've got this secret campaign of drone strikes that, you know, hardly anybody knows, you know, what's going on. And one chapter in my book deals specifically with this and with the fact that in Pakistan, for example, you can have drone strikes that are ordered against targets where we don't even know who we're trying to kill anymore. If you see a building that looks suspicious, where there's people going in and out of it that you think as a, you know, anonymous CIA official are involved somehow with, you know, the Taliban or the Pakistani Taliban, you can order a strike on this. And so there was one strike that ended up killing two Western hostages, and they didn't figure that out until six bodies instead of four were pulled out of the building. And it turned out President Obama didn't even know this had happened, and they didn't even tell him that this had happened until they figured out who these two people were.
And these nut jobs in the United States who think that they're being part of ISIS, like this Omar Mateen who shot up the club in Orlando, or the San Bernardino killers, the husband and wife team. I mean, I think those people are crazed, you know, obsessed. They have nothing going on for themselves, and they get caught up in this ideology. They're not part of the manipulated group. These are just whack jobs doing what they think is right.
Yeah, and there's nothing that, you know, it just plays into the same constant escalation of fear that the American public has, and a certain degree of that, you know, it's legitimate to be afraid. You know, it's easy to see why people are afraid when you have nut jobs like those guys going off all the time. And but the fact of the matter is that we're not made more safe when we have a national security state that is spiraling out of control and which has unlimited access to funds and killing power, and which is killing, in many instances, innocent people overseas and just increasingly, driving up the stakes in this war on terror. And what's the end game? You know, where are we now? The invasion of Iraq has led to ISIS, and now ISIS is spread around the world and includes everybody that wants to be a part of it.
Nicholas Scow with us, and I'm just wondering, when you talk about the CIA controlling the media, why no major reporter will confront the president or anybody else at a news conference and bring up some of those questions we just talked about today. How are they selling oil? How are they pumping it? Where are they getting their weapons? Who's doing the banking for them? Nobody asks those questions.
Yeah, I mean, in my book, I try to actually focus on some of the handful of reporters that are actually pretty independent. There's a couple of really important people out there, people like James Risen, actually the New York Times, and he broke some really important stories on national security agency illegal, you know, wiretapping and a crazy program that we had to try to destabilize Iran that backfired. And these stories, he ended up writing them, and then his own newspaper wouldn't publish them. and sat on these stories for years at the request of the government. So you have to understand that, you know, no matter how hard-hitting reporters try to be, they often are going up against, you know, their own editors who are, you know, caving under pressure. These patterns have, you know, have lasted for a long time, and it's very difficult for them to get this stuff done. But the fact of the matter is, and I confirmed this both with CIA press affairs people and with different reporters that, you know, are very prominent, they give the CIA and the government in general, you know, sort of veto power over what they write. They let them know up front what they're going to report, and then the CIA gets the opportunity to tell them, don't do that. And more often than not, they don't report the stories that the government and the CIA in particular don't want reported.
Just unbelievable what's been going on all around this planet. Are you familiar with the work of the late Michael Hastings?
Yes, and so, I mean, he's just another example of, well, there's been a whole pattern of people that have tried to push the boundaries of stories that the government doesn't want reported that have ended, you know, in their careers ending in unusual circumstances, for sure.
So now with Osama bin Laden in that situation as well, was he he must have been a CIA asset at one point. We gave him money to get the Soviets out of Afghanistan.
Yeah, I mean, our relationship going back with the whole, we created, you know, the first really successful jihad in the 20th century was against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, and the CIA and the Pakistani Intelligence Agency played a critical role in that, and continued to have relationships that lasted after that war ended. And you know, with the example of the Zero Dark 30 story, for example, how the CIA supposedly finally tracked down Osama bin Laden, this was sold to the American public first via press conferences and speeches by President Obama, and then ultimately through Hollywood, where the CIA worked very directly with the producers of this movie to try to tell the public about this cat and mouse game that successfully tracked bin Laden down. And it became controversial because Senator Dianne Feinstein and Senator John McCain attacked the movie, saying that it put out the message that torture works, for example. Well, the strange thing is that you have arguably the best American investigative reporter in history, Seymour Hersh, coming out with an article claiming essentially that the CIA knew where he was all along and that they got this information by paying for it. And you know, no one has disproved this. That's what's so kind of interesting, is that the media did exactly the same job it did against Gary Webb after Seymour Hersh published this story. They came and attacked his personality. They attacked, you know, his sourcing, and just raised all these questions about, like, you know, what the heck has happened to this famous investigative reporter? Has he lost his mind? But none of them, you know, got to the truth of the matter. And then eventually other reporters started actually backing up some of his work. And I wouldn't be surprised if that story ends up completely debunking the official story that the White House put out.
Where do we stand today now with the CIA and with reporters?
You know, I talked to one very successful national security reporter that quite candidly told me that he's lucky if he knows 20% about any particular story that he's working on. I mean, the stuff that we find out about that the government is up to is just a tiny slice of what's actually happening. And the Zero Dark 30 story is a perfect example of that. I mean, it's going to take some time for the full story in that case to come out. But it's just one example of how on any given topic, we really only know just a tiny amount of information about what's actually happening. And that's scary. I mean, if the people that are supposed to be kind of acting as a watchdog against American, you know, power are completely unaware of what's actually happening and depending on you know, whatever little tidbits that they can glean, it's very scary to think about how little we know.
I'm in St. Louis for a couple weeks, Nick, and George W. Bush is about 15 miles away from where I am right now at an event fundraiser for state senator, federal, you know, U.S. senator. But I'm wondering, how much does a president really know?
Well, I mean, That story with the drone attacks that I was describing just shows you how out of control things really are.
Yeah,
I
mean, they don't know much.
They don't. I mean, they only President Obama found out about the death of two hostages killed by one of our drone strikes months after it happened. And, you know, it's just very scary to think of the fact that this is just a machine, basically. There's an invisible hand that the CIA basically has been able to wield successfully, and it doesn't matter that they don't directly pay for stories to be published, that they don't have to directly, like, employ reporters. It's just a machine that's already kind of cranking out stories that that basically put out the same message the CIA wants put out there, and that's more or less the script that everybody's reading.
Do you think we've lost control as a nation?
Yeah, I do. I mean, it's a very scary time that we're living in, for sure. I mean, for example, I grew up in Washington, D.C., and I used to go to Dulles Airport as a kid, and it used to be a game to try to see where the airport was, because it was all farmland up until you finally got to the tower and you could see it. But there is a whole corridor there now of skyscrapers, and it's all the national security state. It's all these contractors, endless amounts of private corporations that have been building themselves off of this war on terror. And it's something that people just don't really think about as the problem that it is. But it's just a massive, massive industry that's capitalizing on fear. And it's good for, you know, corporations that are able to make money off it. But it's never going to end unless we figure out another strategy.
Well, that's an important point. It's never going to end unless we come up with some kind of strategy, because the power brokers will continue to create this fear mongering, this keeping us on edge, because that's when we beg for help.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, that's what the book tries to tackle, and I think it's a start to try to get a little bit of honest discussion going about exactly what we know and what we don't know, and what the nature of the media's relationship is with the CIA, because most people, there's a lot of distrust about the media, a lot of cynicism, but there's also reporters out there that are really trying to do this work and really trying to get to the truth. And I think, you know, to the extent that, you know, you can tell that story and focus on the people that are actually trying to challenge that and what they're running up against, it's worth doing, because it's, our nation is only healthy to the extent that we have, like, a healthy press, and we don't.
Did Gary Webb really kill himself, or was he murdered?
Yeah, actually, that's where my book, Kill the Messenger, starts, was with his suicide, which he pretty much planned out in great detail, and he died.
We think.
Well, I have to say, you got to read the book to get the details on that.
But yeah,
it's pretty clear to me, and I knew him, and I knew his family.
Was he depressed?
He was. Yeah, he suffered from clinical depression for sure. I mean, look at what happened to him. My whole point about his death is that to believe that the CIA would somehow orchestrate his murder 10 years after his career had already been destroyed, at a point when he had to move into his mother's house and was unable to make house payments and had gone through a difficult divorce, it's letting the media off the hook. It's the media that actually worked on behalf of the CIA without even having to do that, but just doing it because that's the relationship that they have nowadays.
Well, it's a feeding frenzy.
They destroyed this guy.
Isn't it? It's a feeding frenzy.
That's exactly what it is. That's actually the title of one of the chapters of Kill the Messenger. I really urge people to read that book to try to get to the bottom of what happened to Gary Webb, and will not let the media off the hook when it comes for what happened to him.
And in the movie, Jeremy Renner played Gary Webb, did he not?
Yes, he did, and did a fantastic job. It was very, you know, it was a kind of bittersweet thing for me to be involved with that. But being on the set and meeting Jeremy Renner was really, was very exciting. And Gary Webb's family was very happy with the film, and so that was the most important
thing. And did it echo your book? Because a lot of times Hollywood falls short on that.
It actually did. And so the screenplay was written by Peter Landisman, who's actually an ex-journalist himself. So he did his own investigating and actually found out some new material that I hadn't even come across myself when I wrote the book. But it definitely did. You know, it certainly tells the story in a very thrilling way, and it's in some ways more exciting than what really happened. But the CIA ultimately admitted that a lot of what Gary had written was actually accurate. And this movie, I think, very, powerfully captures the fact that the stories that he had written were vindicated, and he was actually a hero of journalism that people should really celebrate.
Why do I think that you're not going to stop at these two books? What's next for you, Nicholas?
I'm just going to continue to do the work that I'm working on. It's really important to try to get to the bottom of all the crazy stories that are happening out there. And so my next project, whatever it's going to be, is just going to continue with the same vein of trying to shine a spotlight on the most important stories that are out there. But it's been an interesting experience for me, for sure, to actually talk to the reporters that are being confronted with this very powerful spin campaign by the CIA and how they do their work. And there's so many stories that haven't been made public yet.
We're going to come back and take some phone calls with you in the final hour next on Coast to Coast AM.